Blog Talk Radio.
It's too young to be on that bridge. It's too young to be sitting on the edge. Too young to be lost. You're too young.
Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, a spiritual relationship expert helping men and women heal their bodies, their relationships, and their lives through love, and author of the book Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me, and director of HealthyBabyBoomersNetwork.com. This show is all about creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter how old you are now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can, and often does, get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Today, I am speaking with a most courageous, unique, and self-determined woman who has created a legacy of valuable books about creating pleasure in sexuality, a subject that, even though we may think we are cool, many of us are still afraid to talk about, and to talk about with such depth and openness and clarity. To give you a flavor, let me share with you some of Susan Crane Bacow's book titles: The Sex Bible, Daily Sex Bible, Inspirations and Techniques for the Best Year of Sex Ever, The Sex Bible for Women, The Orgasm Bible, The Orgasm Loop, The New Tantra, Simple and Sexy, The Little Book of the Big Orgasm, and Best Sex Ever. Susan Crane Bacow is an outspoken champion of female and male sexual empowerment, a research sexologist, a sex educator, a magazine journalist, and a prolific author and blogger. She has chosen to be an example of sexual freedom and has created some unique and revolutionary techniques and tips for sexual pleasure, such as the orgasm loop and the sex wardrobe basics. But today, although we will begin with a brief overview of Susan's interesting and provocative lifestyle and subject matter, today we will be talking about a more serious yet powerful topic. In alignment with Susan's intention to be on the cutting edge, to be true to her own self, and to live her life to the fullest, she has become an advocate and an example for choosing her own way to live out her final days. An intro to her first blog post is available at HealthyBabyBoomersNetwork.com. I am delighted and honored to introduce you to Susan Crane Bacow, an amazing lady. So, welcome, Susan.
Well, thank you. That's quite a build-up. I'm not sure I can live up to it. But thank you very much.
I'm sure you will. I'm so happy to have you here. So, I would like to begin by asking you to tell a little bit about your life journey prior to the present moment. Tell us about your background and training and what led you to focus so directly on sexuality and sexual pleasure.
Honestly, I stumbled into my true life's work. I have degrees in physics and math, and I was married young, had a baby at 20, my only child, divorced at 30. And when I got divorced, I didn't want to use the degrees I'd earned. So I said, I'm going to be a freelance writer. My mother called her chair back again. I said, no, I can do this. And living in the St. Louis area, I did become a freelance writer. One of my markets was St. Louis Magazine. My editor there was very good at nurturing writers, and I learned a lot from him. He was very much more skilled than you would expect for a regional city magazine editor. He sent me to interview Masters and Johnson as they were in their waning days and ready to give up their practice. And the article that I wrote was a cover story for St. Louis Magazine, won some journalism prizes, and people from New York started calling and asking me to write about sex. And that is really how I got into it. It's just kind of handed to me. I always been very comfortable talking about sex, and I always like
well,
the
they
mom.
Also say you don't always seek your work or your career. Sometimes it finds you.
That is very true. I feel like it found me. I wrote about a lot of things in those early years after I was divorced, and this is the one that really captured me. I studied with a lot of people, including Helen Singer Kaplan and some of the really great people. I ghosted for Dr. Ruth for a while, and I learned so much from her. It's like getting a PhD in sex. So that became more and more, that became my predominant interest. And then one day I realized I can't write about anything else because nobody will let me. You are really branded when you write graphically about sex. When you write sexually explicit material, you are branded. I did not realize how much I might have thought it over, but overall, I've been very happy with what I do. I am passionate about women reaching orgasm. I just will not listen to people who say, oh, orgasm isn't that important. Yes, it is. Nobody ever says, men never say orgasm isn't that important. Do you ever hear men say that? No, of course it's important. So I'm very passionate about that, and I worked 4 years developing the orgasm loop, tested it on 500 women, and it really does work, and I'm very proud of it. I'm proud of the sex. I have my annual allergies. That's why I sound like this. It's allergy time out here.
Yeah, so, it sounds a little bit unclear on the tape.
Oh, dear. That's too bad because I have like a frog in my throat.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll try to enunciate more clearly in spite of it. Anyway, the sex wardrobe basics are a lot of fun. The idea is that many women want to wear something to bed because they have some body issues. They don't want to be entirely naked. So I built sex techniques around favorite items of clothing, like the boyfriend shirt quickie and skinny jeans, BJ orgasm, and built all these things around items of clothing. And they're very popular, especially the
BJ. That sounds wonderful, especially as people are aging.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. Exactly. It's perfect for baby boomers. Because
right,
most
a little,
of us,
you can hide parts of your body.
Yeah. So there's got something. Everybody's got something they're not happy with, don't you think?
Absolutely.
So I created that, and it's been really popular. It's the most popular thing on my blog, Sexy Prime. In fact, sometimes I wonder why I ever wrote anything other than the basic black dress and blowjobs. It gets hit so many times every day. I could have quit there.
I went to a site called Sexy Prime, and it wasn't yours. So what is your exact website?
Okay, the exact address is sexyprime.typepad.com.
Thank you. Let's get on to the next topic, as much as I could go on and on about the sexuality. How did you find out that you had a serious illness, and what was the diagnosis and the prognosis and treatments recommended, possible outcomes?
Well, I was in Penn Station. I'd just gotten off a train, went to the coffee shop to have a cup of coffee. When I got up, I felt I'd been having some, a little bit of breathing difficulties that, again, I associated with allergies, which has always been my big problem in life. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm having a bronchial asthma attack, which I hadn't had in a few years, but still I thought this is possible. So I started walking toward the escalator, and I couldn't make it. I signaled to a Long Island Railroad cop, and he came over and I said, I think I'm going to fall. I think I'm going to collapse. You're going to have to help me. I think I'm having an asthma attack or something. So he took me to the medics, and they put me in an ambulance and took me straight to Bellevue Hospital, which was the closest place. And as little as I know about medical facilities, because I've been really healthy, I thought it was a psychiatric hospital.
Right, so you thought you were bringing...
Right. And I said, wait a minute, you can tell I'm crazy just by looking at me. They always take you to the closest hospital unless you specifically ask for another one. Mm-hmm. And since I really didn't have any relationship with hospitals, that's where I ended up. But they were fabulous. They took me right in. They took one look at me and they thought it was a pulmonary embolism. And they started doing the scans for the blood clots, and they stuck one needle in my arm for a blood thinner. And I told them about all my allergies. So they stuck another needle in my arm for allergy drugs. And they had all that going before they even got me to x-ray. Well, in x-ray, they found out, yes, I did have a pulmonary embolism and also a very suspicious shadow. So they admitted me, and we did a few days of tests, and they discovered that I had cancer, that it started in the lymph nodes, spread to the breast and the bones. It's in the rib bones.
Wow.
So a very bad prognosis, you know.
And when did this happen?
It's been about 6 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
Terrible
really?
Prognosis. I have spent the last 6 weeks, you know, doing what I wanted to do. They told me don't travel, so immediately I went down to Baltimore to visit my best friend. And I've been to Illinois visiting family because this is my life. They can't tell me not to travel.
Wow.
If I've only got a short amount of time left, I'm going to spend it the way I want to spend it. In the hospital, the oncologist told me what they would do. They were going to perform surgery and chemo and radiation. And squads of oncologists came to me. And I looked at the test results. I'm pretty good at looking at tests. Even as I was getting the test taken, I insisted that the technicians show me what they were doing. Like, don't hide it behind a drape or anything. I need to see
right.
it. I need to see what's on that screen. I need to know what you're doing. I need to know what it means. So they told me, because if you ask, you know, in a firm way, they will show
yes, you have to be very firm.
You do. You have to be firm and not emotional. You have to be very calm and have your wits about you and be firm. Otherwise, mm-hmm. And they don't volunteer anything. They only answer questions. So I pushed each one of these oncologists to the wall, and I said, okay, if you do this for me, what, are you going to cure me? No.
Mm-hmm.
Am I curable? No. I said, okay, why would we be doing this? What would it benefit me? Will it give me years of extra life? No. Probably a few.
Wow.
A few months of misery. You know, once they start the surgery and the chemo, I would still be in bed. 6 weeks later,
wow.
I'd still be miserable. I would still be in agony. And I said, well, what is the point of this? Why would I do this? Why would I give up whatever good time I've got left for this? So I'm under the care of a palliative care doctor now. And she basically, her goal in life is to make me comfortable. One of the problems with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is infections because your lymph system is shot, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another reason why chemo is a bad idea. Chemo attacks your immune system. If you've already got a compromised immune system, why would you think that chemo would be a good idea? Right?
Absolutely. So I wanted to ask, have you thought about trying any alternative methods?
Well, I did some research. I looked at the alternatives. There are a few drugs like tamoxifen, but I don't have the kind of cancer that you have to have the right kind of cancer. It doesn't respond, and I don't. So, you know, what is available doesn't seem to work for me. I've been invited to join clinical trials at different places.
Mm-hmm.
And I have heard from doctors who've read the blog and said, you know, come to Duke or come here, come there and do a clinical trial. But that just means they torture you to death.
Right.
Those people are noble. When you agree to a clinical trial, you know that it could be a very painful, ugly outcome. Nobody's
right.
guaranteeing you that this drug is going to be a miracle. And so far, none of them have been. So you're really signing on to something very difficult. Those people are brave. That's brave. I'm not that brave. They're furthering medical research.
Science, right.
Yeah, they are. They really are. Now, I'm not that brave. My first question was, when can I expect
to
start?
Yeah. More
and
on the lines of, like, raw foods or nutritional changes or something like
that. You know,
that.
I've gotten emails from people who say, if you tried raw foods, if you tried aggressive nutritional therapy, I cannot believe that aggressive nutritional therapy stands a chance against stage 4 cancer.
Right.
I really can't. I don't believe raw foods are going to cure that.
Right. It is a point. Right.
And I'm not giving up my chocolate and my wine and my Italian food and all of that as long as I can enjoy it and putting myself on some draconian regime. I just don't see doing it. I don't
well,
see
I
any
admire
evidence.
You for wanting to live to the hilt.
Absolutely.
Just enjoy
it. In a way,
it.
I think I'm lucky because I know that I have limited time and that allows me to do the things that I want to do and to really appreciate the time that's left and to get things in order. Most people don't have it. Most people who have cancer and go in for the extreme treatment are so caught up in the treatment and the hope, you know, they're hooked on hope, that they don't prepare to die. They have no time to prepare to die.
And they're not enjoying life.
It.
Life is all
no.
about doctors and hospitals and treatments.
Exactly. Which makes sense if you're going to extend your life by years. You know,
right.
I have a friend who went through some very serious surgery and chemo for ovarian cancer. But it's already extended her life by a year. And she is cancer-free, and the hope is that she has more good years ahead. So it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not against treatment for everybody, but I think if someone, if you get them to admit to you, you've got maybe 6 months, why would you waste that in treatment? When they tell
well,
you that
I just heard
might
a lady,
increase your life by 2 months.
I just heard somebody right outside of the drugstore CVS who said to another guy about a friend of hers, she was given 3 months to live, and it's like 16 months later, and she's still here.
Well, that could be, too. You never know.
You never know. So some of it, what's important is to keep your attitude as positive and enjoy life as much as possible as you're
Make
doing.
Make the most out of whatever time is left. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I think that's a good lesson for all of us, no matter if we know we're
example.
Dying or not. You know?
Mhm. So,
really
how have your friends?
Great mail. How my
sorry,
friends?
How do your friends and relatives feel about all of this?
Pretty much, I haven't really had any arguments from anybody. They once they are aware of the odds and you know they agree with me. Most of my friends and family have said I would do this or I hope I would do this if I were in your place. Because the treatment, we've all seen people who've gone through horrible treatment and died anyway. So if your odds are, if you're at stage 4 and you're non-Hodgkin's, which is not ever a pretty outcome. Jackie Onassis died of that. And
right.
I don't recall the details exactly.
No,
but
she didn't.
Told,
she refused treatment also.
Exactly. And she lived about 6 months. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
She refused treatment. When you're given those kind of odds and you know how ugly the treatment's going to be, it seems foolish not to spend your time enjoying life. And why put yourself through that? It
Absolutely.
Doesn't make any sense. I think
That's
so
true.
Many people do it because they don't ask the questions. And they list, the oncologists are taught to fight. That's their big word, fight. They're going to fight cancer. And
mm-hmm.
That's all they know, fight cancer. If they get out and they radiate you and chemo you and you seem to they seem to have won their battle, it doesn't matter if you die 2 weeks later. They've won
right.
their battle. And that's what people don't realize and need to look at, really need to look at it. Plus, the post I'm writing that will go up on the blog later is all about money. Some of my own personal money issues come into it, but the money question that everybody should relate to is what are we spending on end-of-life care? Why are we spending it? And what isn't this part of our healthcare crisis? We need to look at this, and nobody wants to. Nobody wants
right.
to say,
nobody oh, wants to.
They don't. They really don't. So we keep treating, we keep spending all this money. 80% of the money that you will spend on healthcare will be spent in the last year of your life. Does that make any sense?
No. It sounds
no,
crazy.
No, it doesn't. It is crazy. They're beginning to have these discussions about rationing healthcare and about the cost of healthcare, particularly or cancer is concerned in Great Britain, but we're not having them here yet. So I've linked to a couple of articles in the Telegraph. They're excellent pieces. People need to have this discussion in this country. We need to start talking about it. Every time the healthcare crisis comes up, no one mentions this. No one talks about it. It's always, we're going to protect Medicare. Well, how much of Medicare is spent on that 80% end of life?
Well, nobody talks about it because when you're younger, you don't want to deal with it. You don't think it's going to happen to you for some reason.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of older people don't want to take the responsibility on themselves as you're doing. They just, like, let themselves fall into the hands of the medical profession. And friends and relatives
exactly.
tell you, you should do this, you know.
I've had some people tell me, at 60, I'm too young to be dying of this. And I said, I've heard from people in their 40s who are dying of this or who lost family members or friends. And I'm sure there are stories of people in their 30s and younger.
I remember when my...
27-year-old. Go ahead.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. When my mother was dying, she died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. She was really, her voice was weak, she was at home, and I would have liked it to just let herself die there, but my aunt insisted mm-hmm. she go to the hospital. And in the hospital, she kept getting injected, and, you know, they put her through stuff.
Yes.
It was a shame.
I've heard so many of those stories since I started writing these blog posts. People are writing to me and telling me about friends and relatives. A woman in her 40s wrote about her best friend. They've been friends since they were in kindergarten. So this woman is about 42, and she's been undergoing extreme cancer treatments for the last couple of years, but the cancer keeps spreading. Now she's contemplating having her jaw removed and part of her brain. Somebody needs to say, stop. Quit now.
Wow.
Die. You know, you're going to die. You need to think about it. You need to get yourself ready for that. Get your affairs in order. Don't do any more.
Wow.
So the woman who wrote to me was very upset. She said, I wish I could talk to my friend, but she will not listen. The doctors keep outlining these strategies, and as long as they do that, she's not going to listen to me.
Right.
I think doctors really need to reexamine how they treat cancer. They need to be more
how
honest.
How they treat all kinds of illnesses.
Yes, yes, they really, really do.
So is there anything you feel that you have not yet faced or handled or anything you're afraid of at this point?
Well, my only fear is pain. I talk about that to my palliative care doctor, and she assures me that, you know, once you are in palliative care, and I would end my life in hospice, she said, they give you as much pain medication as you need because there's no worry that you're going to become addicted. You're clearly there to die, and they give you what you need. So that's encouraging. That's very encouraging. That is the only thing I fear. That is my big fear.
So that can make you feel more mellow at that point and not be in severe pain. Because that's another thing I saw in the hospital visiting my mother. There was someone in another room screaming, and nobody was coming to that person's help.
We don't medicate pain very well in this country. We really don't. That's one of the things that need to be examined, too. But they, at the hospice, they do better. That I'm sure of. I've done enough study on that.
Oh, I'm sure of. And I have several friends that are hospice workers, and they're so caring and compassionate.
Yes, I think they are.
Yeah.
To go into that kind of work, I think you would have to really have a feeling for it. Otherwise, you couldn't do it.
So having someone there with you to go through that at the end, someone caring and gentle, that's nice.
And someone that you're not related to. One of my nieces wants me to stay with her, and she said, we can have hospice come in and you can stay with me in my home. And I said, no, I don't want that. I want my dignity and I want my privacy. I don't want that, and I don't want to expose your children to it. That's just, I want them to remember me having fun with them,
mm-hmm.
doing things with them, not dying in the other room. I don't want that.
Wow.
It's amazing
so
how many... Go ahead.
With every aspect, you're taking control, and people don't usually think in terms of taking control.
No, they don't, and that is a mistake. You need to do your own research. You need to find out the questions to ask, because they're not going to tell you anything you don't ask. The doctors don't volunteer anything. So number one in being your own advocate is to do your own research. That's really important. That's if I can get one message out to people, that's it. Do your own research. Ask the right questions, because they really can't lie to you if you ask the right questions.
Right. Well, that's where it helps to have, if you have someone else come with you to the doctor, you know, to ask.
Unless you have a research background like I do. So I'm so familiar with research and so comfortable doing it that to me it's, you know, I automatically go into that kind of scientific mode when something happens. But, yes, most people are not like that, and they probably should have someone with them.
Right, someone else to ask the questions so you're not so emotional. Maybe write a list of questions before you go in. So now I have a personal question also. Are there any times where you're feeling sorry for yourself? You've had such a vibrant life, and all of a sudden it's changing.
No, I'm really not. I felt sorrier for myself at other points in my life.
That's
I really
funny.
Don't feel sorry for myself. I think that once you get into your 50s, unless you're just a vegetable, you have to realize life will end. I think it was Bill Maher who said once you pass 50, you can see down the hill. You know it's down there. I mean, you can't kid yourself anymore. It's there. And I think that should be true, or is true for most of us. So it shouldn't be such a major shock to find out at 60, or if you're 65 or 70 or what. It shouldn't be a shock. It really shouldn't be that hard. And to find it out when you have time to deal with it is a blessing.
Wow.
It truly is. My great fear of before this happened was that I would have a stroke. My mother died from heart complications, but not till she was 97. My sisters and my niece died younger from heart-related things. And my fear was, I'll have one of those horrible strokes that leaves you hanging over the side of the wheelchair, drooling out of one corner of your mouth. And I thought, oh, God, anything but that. So I look at this as a gain. It's not that. I would hate to spend years in a nursing home in that sort of condition.
Well, I love what you said about enjoying your Italian food and your chocolate and exactly
and my red wine.
And the red wine. Wow.
Yes.
So, Susan, it's coming toward the end, and I want to thank you so much for sharing your very personal journey. And to read Susan's blog, I want to give it clearly a couple of times. It's http://sexyprime.typepad.com. Don't forget to add sexyprime.typepad.com.
And then if they look at the categories on the right-hand side, under Dying the End Game, all the posts I'm writing about this are right there.
Well,
and a new
one goes
up later today.
And find them interesting. And they can also leave a comment.
Yes, definitely. Yes. I really appreciate the comments. I've heard from so many wonderful people. It's amazing.
It is amazing when you put yourself out there, which you've done, and you've done it all your life. So this is just another
I have. I've written about my own orgasm since I was 30.
Well, I applaud you. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Erica. I appreciate it.
On our next show, I'm excited to be interviewing a good friend of mine who has taught me so much about the process of creating products that sell, Jim Harris, otherwise known as Teach Jim, a natural-born teacher who can teach you how to become a profitable producer. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, healthybabyboomersnetwork.com, to get your free report, How to Live to 100 and Beyond, or schedule a coaching or counseling session at drericawellness.com.